14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Aisha Papacha-Bujak, a graduate of Princeton and the MFA program at Arizona State University. Bujak has taught at Oberlin and Minnesota State University and was the director from 2011 to 2013 of the creative writing program at Florida Atlantic University, where she is a professor of English. She's also a contributing editor for the literary journal Copper Nickel. Bujak's stories and essays can be found in One Story, Creative Nonfiction, The Kenyon Review, The Iowa Review, The Fairy Tale Review, and Witness, among others, as well as garnering her an O. Henry Prize and a Pushcart Prize. Aisha Papacha-Bujak is here today to talk about her much-anticipated debut collection of short stories out from W.W. Norton entitled The Trojan War Museum and Other Stories. Publishers Weekly, in their Starred review, calls the 10 stories in the Trojan War Museum remarkable, beguiling, inventive, and humane, marking Bujak as a writer to watch. Kelly Link adds, "This is one of the best and most surprising collections I've read in a long time. A wonder cabinet of stories, every story so singular and marvelous that I spent a long time after each, wanting to linger in the space it had created." Andrea Barrett says, "Aisha Papacha-Bujak shares with Jhumpa Lahiri the gift of fusing distinctive subject matter with an unusually restrained and elegant voice. This marvelous debut collection is truly rare in its range and depth, its deft mastery of history and myth, and its fearless storytelling." Finally, Joshua Ferris says, "Bujak's stories are wide-ranging and capacious, formally playful and moving. They speak on behalf of women who are subject to fate and the tides of history. They speak of overcoming, of falling prey, of overcoming again. They convey history's full force, but also the individual's willfulness, cunning, and compassion. These stories are entirely contemporary and unique." Welcome to Between the Covers, Aisha Papacha-Bujak.
Thank you.
So the Trojan War Museum took you a decade to write, which isn't uncommon for a debut collection of stories. But what seems to me more uncommon is that this isn't just a collection of stories that you wrote between point A and point B, but that instead you came up with the idea for a collection before most of the stories were written. So given that the idea came prior to many of these stories' existences, I was thinking maybe a good place to start would be to talk about the Trojan War Museum as a whole, as a project. And maybe you can walk us through the process of how you came to conceive of it originally and then write your way towards it.
Sure. So first, I was a person who definitely resisted the idea that story collections should have links or that they, you know, need to be anything other than written by the same person. But I was writing stories, trying to figure out how I wanted to write about the Turkish half of my identity. And eventually it occurred to me, partly because I have a colleague who does mixed race studies who I'm good friends with, and I realized, like, I don't have to write about being Turkish. I can write about being someone who is a mixed person of Turkish and American descent, and that I can write about Turkishness through the lens of being an American who has it kind of pop up in her life. And I always say to people that the best example is the same way that Turkishness pops up in a lot of readers' lives, which is they're reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and the Turkish delight comes on the page and tempts, I guess, Edmund, maybe. But my whole life is like that. It's moments of Turkishness kind of appearing in a text and my going, oh, there I am. And so I started writing stories that literally came about with this kind of serendipity where Turkishness would come into my life and I'd think, oh, maybe I want to write a story about that. For example, my dad he would always forget what I knew and what I didn't know about being Turkish. And so he made reference to this Turkish tale that's well known to any Turk, of the wrestler who has his hands chopped off as he's, drowning. And I thought, oh, I have no idea what he's talking about, but I'm going to figure this out and turn it into a short story. Or a friend of mine who's really into magic was talking about the automaton that played chess, and I suddenly yelled out, it's called the Turk, and realized I was going to write a story about that. So that was basically how each of the stories came about, that some element of Turkishness, either through the news or through one of these random episodes, popped into my life, and I thought, oh, is this a story or not? And it didn't always turn out to be the story I thought, but in most cases, it did yield a story. And I kind of liked the serendipity of that, of just letting randomness bring the stories together.
Well, I really like the idea that you had to sort of reconceive who you were as a person as part of conceiving the story collection project. And you've talked about your reluctance to write about your Turkish half before in your essays and other interviews. And I was hoping maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, about why, in the beginning at least, you didn't know whether you should write about the Turkish part of you. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's on the simplest level, I grew up in the U.S. from the time that I was four. My mom's American. I only speak English. I did not have a religious background that connected to being Turkish. I didn't have a cultural background that connected to being Turkish. You know, some of my friends would go to Chinese school or things like that. I don't speak the language. I did not know other Turks. So I...
Other than your dad.
Other than my dad, who my mother likes to tell me was unusual because he was very, very versed in American culture. So he also, as far as being an immigrant dad, was not an immigrant dad that needed me to translate for him. He was very versed in being an American himself. I did feel like, well, who am I to claim Turkishness? And in hindsight, I can also see how it was comfortable to not claim Turkishness, because that would have, that is a layer of difference that I didn't necessarily embrace. I also had a nickname growing up, so I didn't go by Papatya during most of my young life. And so even my name was not an element of Turkishness. And I think that is one thing that changed as an adult, in using my Turkish, very noticeably Turkish to Turks name. I was kind of outed as a part Turk. So I think that's one reason I started to think more about it. Also, I realized I could educate myself. I could stop blaming my parents for not making me proper Turk, and I could learn a lot more and feel more Turkish. But mainly it really was this recognition from other writers who are mixed, who would identify a lot of the same experiences of saying, oh, well, maybe I'm not Indian enough or Chinese enough or whatever it is to claim that. But then if you're mixed, you are this third thing, and I feel like that's the proper thing to claim. And I'm not sure that anybody reading my stories would necessarily recognize that that's what's happening, but it was for me enough permission to figure out how to write about that element. And partly I enjoyed just following my curiosity, which I had developed as an adult, that I didn't seem to have in quite the same way as a kid.
Hmm. Well, I really like a couple things you said about mixed identity. One was, it took me a while to learn that hybridity does not contain separate contrasting elements, but rather is the blend of those elements, which you've spoken to. But you've also hinted at this other thing about this middle or third identity, in the sense that your father, even though he's fully Turkish and a Turkish immigrant, was very versed in American culture. You've talked about how you're not just influenced by your mother being American and your father being Turkish, but also that you're influenced by your mother's attraction to a Turk and your father's attraction to an American, which I just think is this really brilliant reframing.
Yeah, I think that was something that also I didn't figure out till I was well into adulthood, that I am influenced a lot more by my parents' curiosity than by their actual cultural identities, and that really they always both read international authors and listened to international music and watched international films. And so that was just very normal to me growing up. And I think that has been a really positive influence in terms of just being open-minded about influence and experiencing different forms of art.
So I want to start by talking about the story that ends the collection, the Gathering of Desire, because for me, there was something about this story that felt iconic in relationship to the collection as a whole. So I was hoping maybe before I ask you some questions about it, if you could talk to us about more in detail about the Mechanical Turk that you've referenced and how that story came together for you.
So that is one, like I was starting to say before, that was one of these serendipity moments where my friend and I went to this showing of All About Eve where one of the stars was there. This is in South Florida. And it was a very surreal evening. So I just mention it because I feel like it sets the tone for creativity, where this former star who played like the best friend, I'm forgetting her name, unfortunately. She was like 90 and they trotted her out to talk about the movie, which she seemed to have no memory of. And then her very young boyfriend came out and sang, and it became clear that the real reason she had agreed to do this was to present him singing. And so it was this strange evening, just for context. And then my friend and I were just talking, you know, waiting for the show or something. And he starts talking about magic and how really the most interesting thing about magic is the mechanics. And so then he references automatons, and I started yelling about the Turk, and I thought, I want to go home and write this story. But all in all, it just felt like, oh, this is this. It was a fun memory for me that I liked building a story out of. So I think sometimes we're partly just finding ways to have fun with what is a lot of hard work most of the time. And so I liked having that as the inspiration moment. But then, so I started reading about the Mechanical Turk itself, which basically is dressed like an Ottoman and had this huge cabinet that was hiding a man who was actually operating the machine. And the man inside the Turk was a chess master. And so the Turk was the automaton was very good at playing chess because this guy was very good at sitting inside this dark little space and playing chess. And so the story was going to be about him because that seemed pretty interesting in and of itself. But then I found out that there's this very small number of people who beat the Turk. Hopefully I'm getting this right and remembering this right. One of them was a woman, and I could not find anything out about her. But I thought, well, that's interesting. And that happened to have taken place in Philadelphia, which is near where I grew up. And so I thought, oh, I'll just use Philadelphia because that's kind of fun for me. I can research Philadelphia. Then I think because I just like introducing the element of the surreal or the magic and the cultural tales, that's when the automaton itself had a kind of omniscience in the story. Hmm. And set the story basically has these three voices that follow the three characters, the Turk, the guy inside, and the woman who defeats him.
Yeah. Well, many of your stories, this one included, have a fantastical fairy tale like feel to them, and yet are improbably based on real things like the Mechanical Turk. So I would often find myself going to the internet to see which parts of the stories were fully imagined and which were historical, because it's not really clear because you choose things that are often real but yet fantastical. And it's interesting to learn, at least for me, how big a phenomenon the traveling Mechanical Turk was, that the Mechanical Turk defeated Benjamin Franklin, that the Mechanical Turk defeated Napoleon, and that Edgar Allan Poe wrote about it when he was a journalist. And this is a question that I think would be a through line for that I could ask for many of your stories. And I want to talk about this more fully later, but specific to the Gathering of Desire, what considerations did you have around what to imagine versus what to render from history?
Well, I would have liked to have rendered the setting more, this Philadelphia in this time period. And honestly, I had a hard time fitting it in. I think the voice of the Turk is the more kind of oral narrative, more lyric style in that story. And that I didn't feel like it gave me that much room to switch fully over into a, here's what the world looked like in Philadelphia in this 19th century, and here are the details of the tour of the Turk, et cetera, all of which I actually really thought would be the bulk of the story. And I got a little worried that I was relying too much on the fairy tale, folktale element of the voice. But I honestly, for better or for worse, I couldn't force the story to do what I wanted it to do. So it went this other way. But a lot of times I do have this vision of writing a more realist story that sets the historical ground and creates all these images of what the time period or how I imagine it. And then when I write that stuff, it comes out kind of boring. And so I delete it.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Aisha Papacha Bujak about her debut story collection, The Trojan War Museum. Well, perhaps because the story comes at the end of the collection, and by then I've experienced all the different approaches you take toward.
This is a coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system through broadcast stations in the greater Portland-Vancouver area, including Clackamas, Columbia, Multnomah, and Washington counties in Oregon, and Clark County in Washington. With the cooperation of public safety broadcasters and cable operators, this system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency, official information would have followed the alert tone. This test was originated by Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency in Vancouver, Washington. This concludes this test message.
...tains all things, including what she has lost. What he wishes he could make her understand is there is no her, there is only inside of her. I love that line, and the way you play with who we are inside versus how we appear in the world. And I wanted to take this notion of the Mechanical Turk, who was created to present sort of a fixed notion of what a Turk is to the world. So from what I read, it was designed explicitly to look like the quote-unquote Oriental sorcerer. And to take that and look at how you write about the way you as a person appear in the world. So outside of the book, you've written about two aspects of how you are perceived or misperceived, and one is around the question of whiteness, and then the other, as you've alluded to already, is around your name. And I was kind of wanting to start with your own meditation on your name and how much your name might be a Mechanical Turk or something that you're hidden inside of or something that you're playing against. You gave a talk at AWP called Writing Through the Immigrant Lens, and in it you say, "My mother is American and my father Turkish. I was born in Istanbul but raised in the United States. But all you really need to know about my level of Turkishness is that once a student I didn't know came to my office and said, 'We have the same name.' I said, 'Aisha,' and she said, 'Aisha.' She corrected my pronunciation of my own name. That is the immigrant lens through which I write." I'm sort of hoping you will unpack that for us. How is that the lens, the vantage point from which you approach your writing?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about before of not feeling Turkish enough to write about Turkey. Even thinking about the Gathering of Desire story, I worry a lot that if Turks read this book, they will recognize that the things I'm writing about tend to be the things that Americans notice about Turkey. Like, I fear sounding like a tourist of Turkey. I'm not sure this is answering your question at all, but the Mechanical Turk itself is not something that Turks, I think about. However, the language that you reference at the end of the story about there is no inside of her is something that I got from reading about Sufism. So even that, you mentioned before some of the things you can't tell what's real and what's invented, even some of the language I'm using is actually pretty common to either Turkish folktales or various related religious practices. And I'm lifting that too. And I have a fear that I might be doing some of it wrong. So hopefully I'm still operating in that third space where I'm just mixing what I know and showing how I experience it. But the thing with my name, I definitely, when I meet other Turks, am very, very quick to identify my particular status, because I don't want to look like I'm pretending to be something other than what I am. And I don't know what I think is going to happen, that someone's going to be like, you're not Turkish enough. But I do immediately, because people will speak to me in Turkish and I'll say, I don't speak Turkish. And my mother's American. I go off like on a whole thing that makes me sound nuts, I'm sure.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, about your name too, because I feel like you do this really interesting. I understand the anxieties and of not claiming too much, but you also make an interesting move. So you've written in many places about your name. You also have audio of your father on your website correcting your pronunciation. When I asked for your help in reading the quote that I just read, the two versions.
Yeah, that went really well.
You said you avoided saying your name out loud. You've also written about how students find ways to avoid saying it.
I'm going to stop you, because I don't avoid it. I just not consciously avoid it. I just don't. I think I unconsciously avoid it.
Yeah.
Which I think is different.
Yeah. No, I think so too. And also you've written about how when you lived in Turkey, your American mom wanted you to speak Turkish, but your Turkish dad wanted you to speak English. So you ended up speaking English with a Turkish accent and Turkish with an American accent. So much so that your mom thought you and your brother sounded weird.
Like idiots, is what she actually said.
But you make this interesting move in this essay, Writing Through the Immigrant Lens. Instead of expressing all of this as a source of anguish, you claim this impossible to pin down identity as an asset. You quote Toni Morrison from her book, The Origin of Others, where she says, "At the fence is where the most interesting things happen." And the part of the essay I was hoping you'd elaborate on in light of this idea of writing at the fence is something that, at least at first glance, seems to contradict this a little bit. You say, "Immigrant writers face a lot of pressure to write autobiographically, but I had little interest in writing from my own experience. What I wanted was to be able to write from my point of view." So when I think of you writing at the fence, to me, that feels like that would be you writing from your experience as a mixed heritage writer. So obviously, I don't understand the distinction, and that's what I'm curious about. So tell us how writing from one's point of view is different than writing from one's experience.
Yeah, so I'm very worried about sounding like a egomaniac or something. But I do think I don't hold as much loyalty to one perspective or even one country in the way that sometimes people do. So I don't want to say that I'm more open-minded than other people, because plenty of people are way more open-minded than I am, but I do think I'm open-minded, and I think that I'm writing from that point of view of not feeling loyal to Turkey or America. I'm not suggesting I'm somehow disloyal to either one, but I don't feel a need to hold to a certain narrative that we might be pressured to. Certainly in Turkey, people are pressured to. And something I've often wondered about is if I was in Turkey, where, especially now, but certainly historically, writers are very politically pressured and endangered, if I would be brave enough to write. And so I think maybe I feel like I'm in a safe space where I can criticize everybody. I don't know. Maybe it's not a unique perspective. Maybe you've defeated my whole theory.
Oh, no, I wasn't trying to defeat it. I was just trying to get clarity on how writing a defense might be writing from your point of view rather than your experience, if that's true. Or maybe I misunderstood the connection.
No, I guess maybe the one thing I'm confident of is I'm not writing about my experience. Maybe I'm writing from my experience, but I'm not in any way writing stories about this is what it's like to be me. And I did, when I started writing and figuring out how to write about Turkey, feel pressured to do that, that I wrote in undergrad and grad school more autobiographical stories, which really did read like an American goes abroad tourist stories. I think when I let go of writing about things that had actually happened to me, and particularly embraced doing research and reading other literature that could then influence me. So I guess whether you put that under experience or point of view, I'm not sure, but I'm definitely not writing autobiographically. Also, maybe it's a little bit separate, but I want to get it in here. One thing that I think I resist in terms of my identity is actually, it's kind of funny because now I think feel like because of the book and my writing, like I'm talking a lot about my Turkish self, and I'm thinking, you know, I have been thinking a lot more about it over the past 10 years of writing this book, but also like my American side is really influential in my life, and a lot of sort of who I am comes from the American half of the family and the sort of stories that come from that side of the family. And so it's just interesting for me to observe now that that is being erased, which I do think, not by you, I mean by sort of in general, by the book.
You're becoming more Turkish in the eye of the public.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
And because my mom's family is very WASPy. Our family goes back to, they were colonizers. Some of them were immigrant. They were both colonizers and immigrants throughout, depending on what moment in American history you're talking about. And a lot of them did really, really well financially. And so my grandparents, my mom grew up with a cook and a nanny and all of that. And I did not grow up like that at all. So I am equally fascinated by her past in the same way that I am fascinated by my dad's past. Like they're equally foreign to me and equally interesting. And there's a part of me that thinks, oh, you know, with the things I write next, like, do I want to do an American version? And probably not, because who wants to hear about like rich white WASPs? You know, well, that doesn't feel uninvestigated, right?
Yes.
But I do think my mom's experience is pretty interesting. And
well, speaking of your next project, can you talk a little bit about what because it makes me curious to think you conceive of a book that also sort of requires a certain self-reconception. What would arise as a desire from finishing that book as a next project?
I am working on a novel that has to do with immigration and citizenship, and you would unquestionably think came out of my Turkish part, but it is about a mixed a family that's American and Turkish, so maybe that's more reflective of my own experience. But I had a second novel idea that I'm equally interested to do that has nothing to do with Turkey, and there is, you know, maybe I would write that novel next, except I do feel like I'm supposed to stick to Turkishness a little bit. I'm really genuinely wary of just writing a novel that has nothing to do with Turkey and trying to publish that next. So whether this is a good way to make a decision or not, I feel like, well, first I'll write the novel that's kind of Turkish, and then I'll write the novel that isn't Turkish at all. So I do find, you know, being pressured a little bit to be this certain kind of writer. So I don't know what will happen. I guess we'll see.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
We were talking today to Ayşe Papaca Bucak about her debut story collection from Norton, the Trojan War Museum. been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Heal Right Workshop series for those who identify as Black, Indigenous, or a person of color.
The Heal Right Workshop series is an opportunity for emerging writers of color to connect, share, create, and constructively critique with others that can relate.
The workshops are on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon, and the deadline to register is September 6th, 2019.
Again, that's the Heal Right Workshop series for people who are Black, Indigenous, or POC. The deadline to apply is September 6th.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 11:30, time for Black Book Talk with Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed, who will share their favorite summer reads.
This is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, kind dog, funky dog.
Good morning and welcome to the September edition of Black Book Talk. I am Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus.